A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost, and this is the This Is Money and Share Radio podcast. You can catch me on digital, online, and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1. In the studio with me today for our weekly catch-up, editor Simon Lambert back, joined by consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And on the agenda today, that's all, folks.
Our company was dishonest. And in my German words, we have totally screwed up.
VW's chief exec steps down as it's claimed the car manufacturer could be facing Britain's biggest ever class action lawsuit.
If it is found that UK cars are indeed affected, they have potential claims in breach of contract and under UK consumer legislation.
Well, the scandal's been called the LIBOR moment for the automotive industry, but does it also signal the death knell of diesel? Especially as the government continues its diesel U-turn, we investigate that. And also the return of the highway robber. Those with luxury 4x4s in the capital may want to listen up too. Also on the agenda today, let them eat credit. Britain is a nation that persists in living above its means, so says Simon. For how long can it continue? Mark Carney talks legends and lies as the threat of China continues to loom large over the global economy. Also, the government takes action as confusion continues to reign over plastic bag tax.
From the 5th of October 2015, large shops in England will have to charge 5p for all single-use plastic carrier bags they provide.
I'll tell you what, the definition of a plastic carrier bag is a lot more complex than you might think. Also, we'll explore whether an average London home could really hit £1 million in under 5 years and why elderly homeowners are coming under fire. We also assess the latest online bank targeting the Facebook generation with an unusual social media twist to attract potential customers. A good idea or just a cheap gimmick? But we're focusing our attention today on the week's biggest story and asking what you make of VW now. Would it put you off getting one of those cars? Perhaps a diesel as well. And if it doesn't, what would it take you to go green? A very good morning, editor Simon Lambert. A very good morning, Lee Boyce.
Good morning, Georgie.
I'm going to ask those questions to you from the gut instinct, not as a finance journalist. What have you made of VW's story?
I think it's pretty shocking, actually, to be perfectly honest. The big difference between this and something like the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill is that was an accident. Mm. You know, companies get hit by these kind of accidents all the time. And this is why we tell investors that they should diversify. They shouldn't put all their eggs in one basket. The VW thing, though, it's deliberate. They were deliberately cheating the system. And there's always been this situation in the background that we've reported on in the past, and many others have before, about how car manufacturers effectively game the system with some of the tests that they have to do. So your car in the real world doesn't perform anywhere like it does with the official tests. But this is just blatant cheating. It is absolutely astonishing.
Well, we heard there the boss of Volkswagen in America, Michael Horn, saying we screwed up. I mean, screwed up surely would be, oops-a-daisy, we put a decimal point in the wrong place. This was really deliberate, wasn't it, Lee?
It was deliberate, and you have to wonder, are other car manufacturers going to fall into this? Because it has been quite quiet. You know, usually if you were a rival car maker, you'd be jumping on the back of this, wouldn't you, really? Mm. It's been a bit of a silence, and I'm starting to wonder now, could other car manufacturers be involved in this? And if they are, it could be all diesel cars, basically, worldwide.
We'll explore this in much more detail, yeah. But Lee, would it put you off buying a VW?
It's a tough question, that. It would put me off buying a diesel VW, mm. That's for sure. But yeah, I quite like the Golf. It's still a nice car. It's a solid car. It has been over decades. But what else are they lying about? As a consumer, I would be a little bit concerned.
Absolutely. Simon, you? Would it put you off?
I don't think it necessarily would put me off buying a VW. They are good cars. And the Golf, for example, as Lee said, is a fantastic car. Do you remember the advertising line in the 80s? If only everything in life was as reliable as a Golf. Or as a Volkswagen, actually. Everything was as reliable as a Volkswagen. Clearly not, as it turns out. But I don't think I would buy another diesel car now. So I've got a diesel car. Our family car is a diesel car. And we bought it for a number of reasons. A, better fuel economy, cheaper road tax, and also we have our parking graded on CO2 emissions, so it was cheaper for that. Actually, diesels can be quite nice to drive. The way they drive can be quite good. But I think modern petrol engines are so much better than they were 10 years ago, our car's nearly 10 years old, that I don't think I'd buy another diesel now.
Annie, what have people been saying?
Well, variety of opinion, actually. Adrian said, I think the fact this has come to light is a good thing. Global companies like VW are so wealthy, they think they're above the law, and hopefully they now face the consequences for their actions. Where was the regulation, he asked. Caroline says, I wouldn't buy a VW at the moment. Mass fraud and mass pollution doesn't really sit well with me. And Rich says, I own a VW Golf, and after 6 years of running brilliantly, I wouldn't part with it. But I do feel massively let down by this scandal and concerned about my car losing value.
We'll have more on this in a few short moments.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Froth. This is Share Radio. We're on digital, we're online, and through that Share Radio mobile app. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up. We're running through some of the top stories that they've been looking at over the past 7 days. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Coming up, the return of Falstaff to our roads. But first, it's been called the LIBOR moment of the automotive industry. I'm talking about the emissions rigging scandal surrounding, of course, Volkswagen. What a week for the German carmaker. Billions wiped off its value. Millions face having their cars recalled. Investigations have been launched across the world. The resignation of chief exec Martin Winterkorn. And now threats of legal action. Well, VW admitted 11 million of their cars sold throughout the world, including here in Britain, may have been fitted with secret software to trick testers into believing they met legal environmental standards. The rub? Well, they didn't. It all started unravelling in the States. Here's the boss of Volkswagen in America, Michael Horn.
As you have seen, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has issued a statement and reality that Volkswagen Group manipulated engine software in our TDI diesel cars and we violated emission standards. So let's be clear about this. Our company was dishonest with the EPA and the California Air Resources Board, and with all of you. And in my German words, we have totally screwed up.
Well, the company now faces fines of up to $18 million, and VW has set aside £5 billion to deal with the crisis. What now, though, for the future of VW and for diesel? Is this just the tip of the iceberg for the industry? Simon and Lee, briefly explain a little bit more about what happened here, how they cheated, and, of course, how all this came to light.
Well, they cheated by putting these defeat device. I keep saying defeat because it's in America, and it but defeat device.
Oh.
Basically, what this does when they test cars, they do it sort of on an off, you know, not in real world conditions. So it will probably just be in a lab, and it will be spinning the wheels, etc., etc. When they were doing this, the engine was put into super efficient running mode. Which basically you can't do on the road. You can't drive the road using this. And what that does is it makes it 40 times cleaner than when the cars are being driven on the road. So this software, it's a bit complex, but this software was being switched on when it was being tested because the car knew it was being tested because certain bits and pieces of it were turned off. So as it was going through, regulators are looking at it and going, oh, you know, it's this clean. But actually, it turns out it's not.
So Simon said earlier, this isn't a whoops, we screwed up. This was a really deliberate...
Something kicked in and it used a chemical called urea, which basically takes out a lot of the nitrogen dioxide and dramatically lowers the readings. The reason why this wouldn't work in a car on the road is because if you were driving in a car on the road, that fluid would swiftly run out and so it would stop having that effect.
So how did all this come to light then? In the States?
Yeah, it was an investigation in the States and it basically emerged that they had been cheating the system and gaming the system. And what's really quite astonishing about this is that, so Volkswagen is on its way to being this all-conquering global car company. It sells about, as the Volkswagen Audi group, it basically sells about half of the cars in Europe by sales volume, which is a phenomenal amount. It declared a couple of years back that it was basically on its way to taking over the world.
Yeah, absolutely. By 2018, their chief executive, who's now resigned, Martin Winterkorn, you have here on This Is Money, confided they expected to be running the world's most profitable, fascinating, sustainable car maker. In May 2013, Forbes magazine published a piece entitled How Volkswagen Will Rule the World.
Yeah, And what's happened with the car industry over recent years is that car makers have managed to get more and more power out of smaller and smaller engines, deliver these amazingly well-performing and well-handling cars at the same time as trumpeting their low emissions. Now, we've had this big backlash against diesel cars because diesel car sales have hugely taken off over the past decade, encouraged by environmental treaties and encouragement to get people to buy low CO2 producing cars, which diesels produce less CO2. The argument is, however, that they produce more of another harmful chemical called nitrogen oxide, which causes breathing difficulties and smog and things like that. Now, the car industry has turned round and said, no, we don't buy into this whole campaigner's research. Yes, nitrogen dioxide is bad for people, but our cars are much, much cleaner than they were years ago. They produce much, much less of this nitrogen dioxide, and you don't need to worry about this. Diesel's still fine. And actually, it turns out that the world's all-conquering car company has been cheating the system in order to lower the amount of this chemical being pumped into the atmosphere. So, understandably, people are very upset about this.
I can understand. How damagingly for a company that's built its reputation on reliability and also for the German psyche as well.
It's absolutely massive. And I saw a stat yesterday, something like 1 in 7 jobs in Germany are linked to the car industry. So that's a massive slap in the face to, you know, workers that are slugging their guts off on those production lines, producing these cars, only for some people perhaps at the top of the company to be pulling these sort of tricks. And it's going to be a massive embarrassment of the German public. I mean, you know, Germans are very hardworking people. I like to think that they're not the sort of people that are going to sort of lie their way to the top. And it's just massive. And investors have, well, we've seen in the share price in the aftermath of this on Monday, I think they crashed by a third. Billions wiped off the value of it. They've recovered ever so slightly in the last couple of days. But, yeah, it's absolutely massive, and it creates a massive load of mistrust for investors.
Of course it does. Simon, go on to about this a little bit more, if you would, the share price. And crunch some numbers for us. What's been going on there?
OK, so at one point, basically, the share price had fallen by about 35% since the scandal emerged, which is an astonishing fall. Now, actually, if you look at the Volkswagen share price, it's been on a downward trend for some months now. So, actually, it's fallen by a lot more than that. But I think that actually this, as I mentioned earlier, this really highlights that kind of thing that we drum on about all the time to investors, which is about diversifying. I was speaking at the stock market show a couple of weeks back. You were there,
yes,
I remember,
you were,
Georgie.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I was talking about diversification. You might look at Volkswagen and say, this is one of the world's biggest blue chip safe companies. I'm going to put my money there. I think it's going to do really, really well. But you don't want to put too much of your money there because something like this suddenly emerges, that sort of black swan moment that you would never have imagined would have happened. And if you've got too much of your money invested in any company like that, then it can seriously damage your wealth. I think one of the other things that needs to be thought about here as well is that across Europe, we have a very big car making industry. But Germany is really the country that is famous for its car making industry and for its car making industry being the best in the world. I'd love to say the British car making industry was the best in the world. I think probably the German
close
one
second.
Is. Close second. I think, you know, maybe we do some luxury cars better. But the rest of Europe, Germany is not necessarily the most popular country with the rest of Europe at the moment due to all the wrangling over the Eurozone, the situation in Greece. There's probably going to be quite a lot of schadenfreude, to use a German word,
very
across
good.
The rest of Europe, looking at Germany and going, knocked off your pedestal now, aren't you?
I imagine so. It does raise the bigger question of the potential emissions rigging across Europe, across the world as well. We spoke to car industry expert Professor David Bailey.
To try and cheat a regulator, particularly in America where they're very powerful, is a really dumb thing to do. So if this proves to be correct, I am genuinely shocked at their behaviour. But if they're doing it in the United States, the question is, are they doing it outside of Europe? And also whether other manufacturers have been engaged in this. For a long time, there has been a concern amongst public health experts that the kind of data that companies come up with when their cars are tested in terms of their emissions of things like nitrous oxide gases is far removed from what happens in reality. There's been something of a political backlash in Europe recently, particularly at city level, around diesel cars, with much tighter regulations coming in cities like Paris. And the industry has been trying to convince policymakers and regulators that actually they had dealt with the problem in terms of the latest regulations in Europe. Now, this reopens all of that. So it's a real issue for the wider industry. And certainly there will be much regulatory scrutiny, I think.
Well, there we go. That was Professor David Bailey there, car industry expert from Aston Business School. It raises the question, how wide could this go? We've heard it being called the LIBOR moment of the automotive industry. I wonder how easy it is for other firms to do this. Lee, you mentioned there earlier that 40 times cleaner during those tests the VWs came out. Does that mean they were 40 times on a scale better than the other cars?
Well, this is the sort of aftermath now. The next couple of weeks, these are sort of questions that are going to be asked, and they're going to have to find the answer to, because it's impossible to tell at the moment if other car makers are doing this. Now, there's a great quote in the Daily Mail this morning from Steve Fowler, who's the editor-in-chief of Auto Express, and he says, if one manufacturer is cheating, what about the others? The silence has been deafening. You would expect other car makers to be making hay at the expense of a rival, but they are not. The industry should be shouting for the rooftops that they are clean. They should come out quickly and say they are not cheating. Has any car manufacturer said that so far? I haven't heard. So I think this is going to be something that's going to rumble on, honestly, for the rest of the year.
Imagine they're all scrambling around going, have we done this?
Have we done this?
I've been on the phone all week to people in my company going, is it us?
Absolutely.
Did we do it?
But it makes you wonder, though, are these tests too stringent for diesel to continue?
Well, there's been a lot of noise made in recent years anyway about emissions and how many miles per gallon cars get. You know, there's all sorts of true MPG figures that come up because critics argue that this system is outdated. It's been around for a long time, the way these cars are tested. And I think there are some changes coming into play in the next couple of years, because a common gripe from drivers is that they never achieve the sort of MPG that is advertised on the car. And it's, you know, done by these stringent European tests. But how many people actually manage to get their miles per gallon, you know, that's been quoted to them in the sales room? It's very minimal. And it's the same with diesel and how much emissions that they're producing. And it's so hard to tell now if your car is emitting more pollution. And that's why they're having to recall a load of cars and actually find out. And as someone's rightly pointed out, it could mean the car in your driveway is about to take a serious dent.
You're going to get recalled, or the fact that it's going to drop in value?
I think they've said about 500,000 cars in Britain are VW that are going to be recalled, roughly, give or take. I think there's going to be some sort of announcement soon. It's quite likely if you bought a VW diesel in the last few years. I mean, I think they've set up some sort of helpline, so you can phone up. I haven't got the details in front of me, I'm afraid, but they've set up some sort of helpline, and I think they're going to be in touch if your car is affected by this.
Simon?
Well, there's a really interesting piece, actually, on the Mail Online. And it's come from Reuters, actually, about this unassuming West Virginia engineer who has been identified as the man responsible for exposing Volkswagen's catastrophic environmental fraud. So Daniel Carter and his small research team at West Virginia University did this small study, basically, that just cost £50,000, which eventually led to this probe by the US regulators. And he said here, and this is quite astonishing, he said that initially the results were so pronounced that they questioned their own research. And he said, the first thing you do is beat yourself up and say, did we not do something right? You always blame yourself, he told Reuters. We saw huge discrepancies. There was one vehicle with 15 to 35 times the emission levels and another vehicle with 10 to 20 times the emissions levels. But he actually says a fix shouldn't involve major changes. He said it could be something very small, can simply be a change in the fuel injection strategy, and what you might end up with is a penalty in fuel consumption in order to get the systems more active to lower the emission results. So it's not that you need to throw the car in the bin. It's not that the car is completely useless. It's just that in order to make that car deliver a combination of very low emissions, very high fuel economy, and very strong performance, basically, it's been tuned up to drive a certain way on the road and then just switch that off in the test and in the test perform how it should. So what the car maker is going to have to do is change that system so that it can now meet the standards that need to be met for that car to have been sold at the time that it was sold. And bear in mind that with these sales restrictions they place on cars, so we at the moment have something called Euro 6, which determines how diesels polluting they can be, that you just have to meet it at the time that the car's on sale. So it's not retrospective. So not every diesel car on the road has to meet those restrictions. It's only the ones that were sold after that date. So VW's going to have some very clever eggheads working in the laboratories right now, working out how to make those cars meet those standards.
I imagine very fast as well. One last issue, actually, you raised it. People are asking the question, if they've lied so blatantly about emissions, what else?
Exactly. And I think, honestly, this is going to be great, I think, for actually getting some real answers and real figures from what cars actually do. And as people keep saying, it could be the tip of the iceberg. I mean, who knows what else this encompasses? Mm. Perhaps it won't encompass anything else, but I think it's going to spotlight is going to definitely be on the car making industry now.
Well, sticking with diesel, it seems the government's done a serious U-turn here. Much to the ire of many, this is Money Reader. Remember when we were offered incentives to buy diesel sold on environmental benefits? Well, no more. Now we're being told diesel drivers could face charges of up to £12.50 to travel into city centres across England. And it's to reduce air pollution, apparently. So, Simon, we've spoken before about this, haven't we? Especially with regards to Islington Council, when they slapped a diesel tax on cars. And you weren't too happy about that. Here's what you said way back in January.
The people who are most likely to be able to get a different kind of car are wealthy people. The people who are least likely to be able to get a different kind of car are people on lower incomes. And so they basically... Not only is a £96 a year tax going to take proportionally more of their income, so it's regressive, they're also less likely to be able to change their behaviour. And this is not nudge theory, this is bludgeon theory, to be perfectly honest. And it's also a little bit convenient that it comes in just at the time when the council are facing more cuts. To be honest, I think it's absolutely disgraceful.
Fantastic. Remind us, Simon, then, back in diesel's heyday, what were we told then about the cars and what's the latest?
Look, I stand by my words there, to be honest.
I don't doubt.
This VW thing doesn't change anything. Basically, we are still being encouraged to buy diesel cars by the road tax system, which grades road tax on car emissions. And also, I'm being encouraged to do so via my parking system, which does exactly the same thing. And after the road tax system came in, a number of years back, Islington introduced this parking system. So basically, the less CO2 your car emitted, the cheaper your parking was, which encouraged the sale of diesel cars. Basically, people went, OK, well, it saves me a little bit of money. It's nudge theory. It doesn't save you that much money. And in fact, actually, because a diesel car costs about £2,000 more than a petrol one, you'd have to buy an awful lot of road tax before you managed to save the gap. But people still did this. Yet now we're being told that diesels are dirtier. So my council's brought in a £96 a year charge on top of its existing parking structure. There's now this talk of different cities around the country bringing in £12.50 charges for anyone to drive a diesel in there to reduce pollution. Now, the government knows that it's got to do something about diesel. It knows absolutely that something is going on. And I don't doubt that there are people discussing these plans. However, at the moment, we are still encouraging people to buy diesel cars. And I think the government needs to step it up a gear and urgently come out and tell people where they stand. Because there are people out there spending tens of thousands of pounds on cars, and it's like, poof, are they going to be taxed? What's going to happen?
I mean, there is a serious issue to this. Official figures claiming that the pollutant you were talking about there, nitrogen dioxide, is responsible for as many as 23,500 deaths in Britain every year, leading to soaring rates of respiratory illnesses in children. Further 29,000 deaths, they say, a year, thought to be caused by sooty particles also produced by diesel vehicles. So there's no question that there's health issues here as well. But Lee, you're already saying that you're spotting the fact that we're buying less diesel already. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's been so much news about diesel, I'd say, even before this VW story has come to light this week. In the last sort of year, it's almost like the grim reaper of diesel is sort of like lurking on diesel drivers because they don't know what's going to happen next. So obviously Simon's talking about the Islington charge. Other councils might start doing that soon. So, you know, instantly you're getting more penalised for that. They're talking about putting this £12.50 fee to enter a major city. So they're talking, obviously, London, but also Birmingham, Leeds, Derby, Nottingham, Southampton. And then, you know, that will just sprawl into like every town and city pretty much.
Is this just in the planning phase?
It's in the planning phase. I think they were talking about perhaps bringing it in from 2020 or something along those lines. But all it's doing is making diesel purchases less attractive now, and which is a complete U-turn from what they were doing previously. And actually, SMMT figures for this year, diesel and petrol were quite an even keel, but over the previous years, diesel had actually overtaken petrol. So I think from 2012 onwards, there's been more diesel cars sold than petrol cars, which is a massive trend change compared to a decade ago. But now I think what you're going to start seeing, we'll see at the end of the year when the full-year figures come out, but I've got a funny, sneaky feeling petrol's just going to overtake diesel this year in sales, and I think that gap will grow. from next year onwards.
What about green alternatives briefly, Lee? Are they a viable alternative?
They've become very popular, and some of these hybrid
but
cars...
But are they good enough? Are they good cars?
Yeah, I think
for
the biggest problem,
sure.
and this is me talking personally, and I think this is a problem that a lot of people would have with green cars, is that the technology's only going to improve and get better, and the mile you're going to be able to get more miles from those sort of like green engines, hybrid engines. So people almost don't want to be at the first of the technology because they want to wait and see what comes. But I test drove a Mitsubishi Outlander hybrid. It sort of kicks into electric when the charge runs down, kicks into petrol, but it recharges as you drive along with kinetic energy. It's very good, and you can get quite a few miles out of it. And I think that sort of thing could be the future.
We've got two more motoring stories to cover, but these are a little bit different. Now, the first involves luxury 4x4s and car crime traced to East Africa. Simon, what's going on here?
Right, well, you know all those expensive luxury cars that get stolen? Ever wondered where they go? Uganda, quite a few of them, apparently, it seems. Basically, there's also been this trend of people having their cars stolen with the keyless entry systems. Thieves manage to reprogram it, get into your brand new car that should theoretically be super secure, and then your brand new car is never seen again. Now, if you were to take that brand new car and try and sell it in the UK, it's highly likely that the person who'd stolen it would get caught, or the person who was fencing it, selling it on. So off they go abroad. And the Lexuses have proved to be very popular in Uganda. Yeah, so that car has made a journey all the way across a couple of continents to be sold there. And I just think that it's amazing. It shows this amazing like globalisation even amongst car thieves.
No, indeed. What I thought was rather interesting, though, this is a hire company. This is how they managed to track it. Have some serious tracking capabilities in their car, unbeknownst to the thieves. But if it was unbeknownst to the thieves, is it also unbeknownst to us as well as we hire out this car and not realise that they're tracking every single place we go?
That is
probably not Uganda, but I mean,
that's
maybe.
We told you
question.
The mileage was limited. You're not allowed to drive to Uganda.
It's a very good question, but I reckon, I remember we had a story, and I know we mentioned it on Share Radio a few months ago, where we were talking about there was a bit of a surge in hire cars being stolen and being shipped away. And it's just sort of gone full circle now. We've got the full details of what's happening with these hire cars. And I wonder, I mean, they don't name the hire firm, but you're right. I wonder if hire car firms are starting to put this sophisticated tracking software in. I'm not sure you'd know, or you wouldn't know it was in there. You'd like to think they're only doing it for this sort of purpose, if it went missing, that they'd activate it. Without all the ins and outs, I don't know, to be honest.
But it's not just hire cars, though, is it, Lee? Because a growing number, you say, of reports showing a spate of 4x4s being stolen, especially in the capital, and it's this keyless ignition system.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have a really posh 4x4. This keyless technology is in quite a lot of cars. Should people be worried?
I generally think people should be quite worried. I mean, it seems to be quite easy for criminals to get some of this software off the internet and be able to sort of crack into cars. And I know manufacturers are sort of massively looking into it and trying to improve the technology and whatnot, but I would have thought they would have been more robust with it and make sure it's completely foolproof before getting it out there. And what's wrong with an old-fashioned key? But I mean,
back in the day
when you used to have your key. But what I would say is that car theft has fallen a lot, and there's been a lot of improvements in the technology. And you know, it's just such an interesting way to see how this car was stolen and how it found itself via France, Oman, Kenya, in Uganda. They've tracked it. They've gone to Uganda and found, you know, 28 cars that have been stolen off the streets. They're £1 million worth of cars.
That's probably what the car was for, driving a bit of off-road rather than down Chelsea High Street.
I watched a documentary a couple of weeks ago on the BBC about South Africa, and it was sort of like about the drug industry out there. And some of the criminals just love to have, you know, they've got 8, 10 4x4s that they just stack up. This is where they've come from. They must be. I'm putting two and two together. But
well, I do want to ask you about one more car crime story. It's the latest scam. Now, if you thought highwaymen were consigned to old stories, well, think again. We're apparently seeing the return of the motorway robber. Insurers are warning the modern Falstaff deliberately crashes into your car and demands cash on the spot. So, Simon, what's going on here?
Well, so from sophisticated cyber car thieves to a very blunt, old-fashioned con trick. Basically, as you're driving along, someone hits you or makes it look like it's your fault. So, crucially, it has to look like it's your fault. So you're driving along, the car in front of you it's maybe behaving a little bit erratically, like going a bit slow and everything, suddenly breaks, you drive into the back of it, they get out, oh, you've damaged my car, is it going to have to go through insurance? I think I've got whiplash. you're thinking, oh no, my no claims bonus, what's going to happen? My insurance is going to rise, my insurer is going to penalise me for the rest of my life on everything I ever do. I wish my car had just gone to Uganda. and the person says, I tell you what, I'll do you a deal. Basically, I won't report it, you just pay me some money. And they ask you for £50 or £200, and you hand over the £50 or the £200, and off they go, with no real damage to their car and no real damage to their neck. And apparently there are organised gangs going around pulling this scam on those they see as vulnerable. So the elderly, people driving around with small children. And it is just a little bit of highway robbery. And but it's amazing, isn't it, how we've seen this just cottage industry grow up around the whole idea of having someone just drive into the back of you.
Editor Simon Lambert. Also, I'm joined in the studio, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. Coming up, we assess the latest online bang targeting the Facebook generation with an unusual social media twist. And also, let them eat credit. Britain is a nation that persists in living above its means, says Simon. But for how long can it continue?
It's Managing My Money! And here is your host, Glenn Goodman!
Hello, I'm Glenn Goodman. Welcome to Managing My Money, the only show in the world where not only do you learn how to manage your money, but you can come out the other end with a university certificate.
Are you sure this is the only show in the world where you can do that?
This is Annie. She's joining us on our magical journey of discovery through the weird and wacky world of money. Did you like that? Wacky.
I'm not sure.
Let's talk about debts. Huge debts. We're not just talking about debts, we're also talking about interest on those debts. Annie, do you know why it's called interest?
No.
Because it's really interesting.
That wouldn't have been my first guess. Let me move your rates up and down till you say stop. Let me play with your money, baby, make you real hot.
Let me do all the quantitative things you want me to do. Cause tonight, baby, I wanna get monetary with you. Yes, for more information, you can go to shareradio.co.uk to find out a little bit more. Or this is money indeed, because you are listening to Share Radio on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm Georgie Frost here with you every weekday from 9 until 1 in the studio with me. Laughing and crying is Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, joined by Editor Simon Lambert. And so far, we've looked at the scandal engulfing VW. Is the end of diesel nigh and highwaymen make a return? And coming up, we'll be casting inquisitive eyes over a new bank on the block and more plastic bag tax confusion. But first, it's been a while since we mentioned Mark Carney here on the show, but it seems the Bank of England governor got a bit philosophical and historical recently, warning of the threat to the global economy of China. Now, he was giving a speech at the Harvard Club UK dinner, likening a 1638 statue of John Harvard, erected to commemorate the founding of the Ivy League University, to the state of our economy in 2015, referring to its alternative name, the Statue of Three Lies. Why the name? Well, because firstly, no one knew what John Harvard actually looked like, and the college was founded in 1636, so 2 years earlier, and goodness me, it transpires, it wasn't even founded by Harvard anyway. So why is it still there? Who did found Harvard? But more importantly for us here, what on earth is Mark Carney going on about? Simon, explain.
A question I asked myself when I saw that, speech. Where's he speaking? What's he doing? What are these three lies? Which you did a very good job of explaining there, Georgie. But what he did was as you said, he got a bit philosophical. He looked at the sort of the credit boom pre-financial crisis, and he looked at where we are now, and he said a bit about what the Bank of England's been doing. And he summed up the attitude, I think, perfectly of the sort of pre-2007 consumer boom with let them eat credit. He said that we were in a debt super cycle. We had the stagnation of middle class real wages, and households had to borrow if they wanted to increase consumption. Let them eat cake had become let them eat credit. But he said that we got complacent. And this was all a part of his first financial lie that he highlighted. And that is, this time it's different. Now, what he was saying was basically there was this thing called the Great Moderation, where we had low inflation, low interest rates, good growth. Some people out there were even suggesting that we might have defeated boom and bust, not to name any names. And it turned out that actually we were massively complacent. There was this sort of global glut of money flowing into bad investments. There was the US housing market, people betting on betting and betting on bets on those bets as well. And the whole thing just blew up. Now, what he said is that our response to that has been to have to learn lessons from the Great Depression. And at the moment, we have this period of super low interest rates, but that the bank has made the financial system safer, that it's learning its lesson. It's not pretending this time it's different. It's trying to put measures in place to stop that happening again. So we've got the bank has more powers for financial stability. It can limit mortgage lending. Banks are required to hold more capital themselves. And so I think he's right. It's a really interesting speech, actually. I'd recommend if anyone's a bit geeky on interest rates and economics like me, they go read it. You can read it in full on the Bank of England website, and we've linked to it from our site. But whilst I think that the banking system might have become safer, and it's true, I'm not entirely certain that the people borrowing all that money in terms of the consumers have become safer, because we are still a nation living above our means with our big mortgages, our massive house price to earnings ratio that's near record levels, our credit cards, our car finance, our loans. Basically, we're filling that gap between our earning and our spending. And you just have to ask, is the medicine that we're getting for the financial crisis of 7 years of super low interest rates just going to make the next one even worse?
Well, you ask, how long can that continue?
I don't know. Can it continue forever? That seems to be
the general
gist. This living persistently above your means, that basically you can just continue on with all of this debt, and you don't worry about the fact that the earnings have not grown in any way in relation to the price of things, and you just continue living in this debt. I mean, I don't think it can continue. I mean, we look at the situation with Greece and we say, well, hey, how's Greece ever going to pay off its debts? This can't continue. Something needs to be done. Well, how different is the UK or the US consumer to Greece?
Mark Carney here, particularly concerned over China, also mentioned in the speech. And yet we see George Osborne cozying up to China recently. What's going on there?
Well, they're in short-term trouble, but they've got a lot of money.
There we go.
So there you go. It's about as simple as that. George Osborne's over there asking the Chinese whether they'd like to buy any more bits of Britain with all that money that they've got. Look, we can't afford to fix these roads. And yeah, we need a couple of new power plants, but we haven't got any more money down the back of the sofa. Would you pay to do it? So Carney is saying that basically China has seen this big growth in household debt as well. And we should be worried about that. We should be looking at that and looking at the parallels with what happened in the sort of developed world in the 2000 to 2007 boom. And we should just be very wary of it. Ultimately, of course, the great irony is that the cure for this concern over China is to keep interest rates lower for even longer.
Well, we'll turn our attention away from the Bank of England and to online banking, shall we, Lee? The new bank on the blog looking to snap up dissatisfied customers who can get better deals the more likes that the bank gets on Facebook. Now, German-owned Fido, the latest online-only bank, is offering 0.25% on current account balances in credit. When they get over 10,000 likes on Facebook, however, this increases to 0.5%. Now, Lee, you've been looking into this. A smart move, a gimmick, does it show actually who they're trying to target, which demographic?
I think, yeah, massively. You could tell that this is a sort of one that's going to be aimed at maybe under 30s.
Who are Fido as well, I should ask?
So they're a firm from Berlin. They've been around for a number of years in Germany, been quite popular out there. I actually did a piece about Germany and savings rates a couple of weeks ago, and actually it's very interesting to see just how low savings rates are in Germany. I know we always moan about them here. They've launched a range of savings rates, they're not attractive at all, which is very interesting at the moment because there has been a glut of challenger banks come out in the last year, 18 months, and they've all been challenging the top of fixed rate savings tables. This Fido's come out and it's not challenging at all. The chief says he wants to obtain 50,000 customers in 3 years, which sounds
modest.
Modest. And when you consider Atom Bank, which is another online bank that's meant to be launching very soon, I think they said they wanted something like 5 million in 3 years. So it probably shows you it's almost like they're slowly getting into the market and seeing what
dipping
it's like. Dipping their toe,
feeling how warm the water is or not. But I'm wondering, though, it's a challenger. You mentioned Atom Bank there, online only, joining the likes of Aldermore, Virgin Money, and the like. But it doesn't have a UK banking licence.
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's applied for it, I believe, in January.
It applied for it, yeah.
Why would you sign up for it?
Well, it still has the protection, the EU-wide safety net of €100,000. So if you put your savings in there, you know, you're gonna be safe if it goes bust from that scheme. I think the most interesting thing is it's launched a current account without a debit card, which I think is quite a fundamental part of a current account at the moment. You know, they say it's coming soon. It's just a bit of a weird one for me. Why didn't they just wait until they had debit cards that they could issue to launch this? I'd be so interested to see how many people have signed up for this since it launched. I'm going to guess not many. But
how many likes has it got on Facebook? Should we find that out?
We should find that out. I reckon we'll have to find out before the end of the show.
I'm sure we will.
I reckon it'll give you some sort of indication. But look, in all joking aside, it's just good to have new banks coming out. You know, there's all sort of challenges coming out. Some are offering current accounts, some are going to be offering savings rates, some are going to be offering both. And all that can mean is more competition, and hopefully nudging savings rates up and just meaning more choice when it comes to who you bank with.
And I think Simon's got an answer.
Lee, how many do they need to get to for this rate to go up?
10,000.
OK, they have got... 384.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
So a fair way to go. I think that's safe to say. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, in the studio with me running through some of the top stories they've been investigating this week. Today I'm joined by editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Now let's turn our attention to house prices, shall we? Just when you think the London bubble couldn't get any bigger, we're being told the average property price in the capital could be £1 million in under 5 years. That's according to Rightmove, who say asking prices in the capital stand at an average £620,000, almost £500 higher than a previous record set in July. So could their predictions come true? Well, earlier I spoke to our personal finance expert, Ed Boucher.
We did see figures coming in earlier this year suggesting that the really sort of prime posh areas of London, we were seeing a slowdown in growth, at least perhaps partly driven by Osborne's changes to stamp duty. But London as a whole, absolutely booming. And again, it also surprises me because 6 months, a year ago, you could see stats how the London house prices were definitely significantly higher than where they were before the crash, even after you take inflation into account, whereas some other parts of the UK, you hadn't really seen much of a rise since 2007, so it looked like they were seeing bigger rises outside London, smaller rises in London, but that no longer seems to be the case.
So, Simon, average house prices in a city, £1 million in under 5 years. Well, I suppose good news if you're an owner sitting in one of these houses, but what hope for buyers, especially first-time buyers?
Well, it's only good news if you're an owner sitting in one of these houses and you don't ever hope to move to another one, because the other one that you're going to move to is probably also have gone up in value. So, Rightmove haven't said that they actually think this is going to happen, but they've said if things continue on at the current pace, it might do. If you were going to buy your average £1 million house and you put down a 20% deposit, you would need a deposit of £200,000. Now, how many people have access to £200,000? How many people's parents have access to £200,000 to raise that deposit? Because let's face it, that's where a lot of people get their deposits from nowadays. Even if you could earn, even if you could raise that £200,000 deposit, you would then need a mortgage for £800,000. Now, working back on a bit of old-fashioned income multiple stuff, at four times your earnings, you would need to be earning £200,000. It's the magic number. Now, a lot of people buy as a couple or as partners, so you'd need to be earning £100,000 each. So basically, you need 100 grand salary, your partner needs 100 grand salary, and you need to find 200 grand, and you'll have to be you'll be taking on an £800,000 mortgage for the next 25 or 30 years.
And with wage growth at 2.9%, I believe it was this year, Simon, we've got under 5 years. Do you reckon we could do that?
I think it's highly unlikely that many people would get there. But let's work it back the other way.
But isn't
the average wage
in London around about 35,000?
Yeah, it's about 35,000. But let's say, OK, well, the average wage, are people with the average wage able to buy? No, only those who are earning, you know, who are good earners in that sort of higher bracket. Now, if you're earning £50,000 a year, you're doing very, very well in life indeed. Basically, even in London, if you earn £50,000 a year, you're doing very, very well. If you and your partner are earning £50,000, then you're both doing very well. So you've got £100,000. Now, if you can convince someone to lend you four times your income, you will have a £400,000 mortgage. And that means that you would only need a deposit of £600,000 to buy the average house. Now, I don't see any reason why this is a problem.
No, not at all, not at all. So, Simon, why these predictions? I'm assuming, one, because we're not building enough homes, quite simply. We've spoken about that a lot. But also, someone else is coming under blame for this, and it's elderly home blockers, they're being called. Now, the Financial Conduct Authority's head of mortgages, Linda Blackwell, says that older homeowners should make space for younger families by downsizing. Now, I'm going to come to you there, Lee, as probably the youngest person in the studio. Not by a long way, don't worry, Simon, but what do you make of what Linda Blackwell said?
It's very difficult to tell someone that's bought a house and lived there for a very long time to move elsewhere if they're not wanting to. You know, they've bought the house. It's their house to do with what they want. But I kind of understand it from both sides of, you know, both sides of the coin, because younger people want to buy the houses that people are sort of, you know, sticking around in that are far too big for them. Yeah. So it's a problem. Now, I've actually got an example of this. A relative of mine who lives in a three-bedroom townhouse by herself, sold the house within about 2 days, wants to downsize, become mortgage-free, perfect. There is nothing out there that's not in a retirement village, which she doesn't want. Just a nice little one-bed flat somewhere.
Well, that's the problem that you highlight in this article. We want to downsize, but it's too expensive. Susan Seller adores her semi-detached five-bedroom home. She wants to downsize, but she says that retirement homes are just simply too costly.
Yeah, it's so true. And the thing is, like, you know, let's say my relative sold a house for £250,000, three-bed, and then a one-bed retirement place was like £190,000, £200,000. The difference is almost like, well, why would I, you know, save myself £50,000 a couple of bedrooms?
I mean, if you're a developer and you're building these retirement homes, you basically want to make as much money as possible. You're running a company, and so your motive is profit. And you want to provide a great place for people to live. And the way to make the most money is to aim for the luxury segment of the market. So you've got these developments where basically people are charging £735,000 for a two-bedroom flat. And OK, yes.
Some of them look great, though.
This is absolutely the top end. They look like fancy hotels. And there's this great scene with, like, these retirement villages. People get to move there. They live with like-minded people. There's a gym, there's a pool, there's a library, there's parkland grounds and everything like that. But they're being very much aimed at the high end. And the stuff at the low end is very few and far between. And let's face it, people are not really developing it. But even when they do develop it at the low end, it still tends to be expensive. And for every one of those bed home blocking old people who sells their four bedroom house and actually does go and buy a one bedroom flat, well, they might have sold their four bedroom house to a family, but they've just wandered in there with all their money and priced a first time buyer out of the market. But there's this wonderful quote from this lady from the FCA. Linda Blackwell told a major conference that Britain did not just have a first-time buyer problem. There are older buyers who basically pay off their mortgage and sit quite happily in a very big house. How dare they? Honestly, if you don't owe money to a bank, get out of your house now. Give it to someone who can take on a mortgage.
Well, let's follow on with the indignation, shall we? The plastic bag for our final story, Simon and Lee. The plastic bag charging debacle continues. In just a couple of weeks, you'll have to pay 5p per plastic bag you pick up at large supermarkets. But now thousands of corner shops are keen on the move as well, even though the law doesn't actually apply to them. Now, the tax is already causing a fair bit of head scratching with what it does and doesn't qualify for a charge. So we asked Londoners what they made of the move.
I think it's good. I prefer the other bags, like you can reuse.
My trouble is I've got all these bags at home that are recyclable and I've never got them with me when I go into Sainsbury's. So that's why I've got bags today.
I think probably it's quite a good idea. You know that you're supposed to take the bags, and we were late.
It's just lazy, isn't it?
We're lazy.
You know, I think we pay enough for our food. They should give us a free bag every now and again.
To put a charge to it, I think it's nuisance.
It's disgusting. You're giving them your money. You're advertising their shop and then they want you to pay for a plastic bag.
When you start selling bags, people will either reuse them, won't throw them away. You won't see pigeons getting trapped in bags. And for recycling, man, green planet. Help the planet.
I think it's going to be a very smelly world because we all use them as dustbin liners.
Well, I do. I use them as dustbin liners and to take my lunch to work. They're not the same bag. That would be pretty disgusting. So remind us of the charge, if you would. Why is it being brought in? Who does it apply to?
So from October the 5th, if you go into supermarket, even found out clothes shops, you have to pay 5p for a bag, but it only applies to larger retailers. So if they employ more than 250 staff, you'll be paying 5p for your plastic bag. Mm. Obviously, to help the environment, we're using far too many plastic bags. And that actually is a good change, in my opinion. However, it's one of those classic government, let's make it as complicated as possible when it should be the simplest thing ever.
Well, interesting you say that, Lee, because the government's taken action. Video for shoppers produced by the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has been published.
Small retailers don't have to charge, but can do so on a voluntary basis. You can avoid paying the charge, either by reusing single-use plastic carrier bags or by using multi-use bags for life. You also won't pay a 5p charge if you're using a paper bag, if you're in transit, or if your bag only contains certain items, such as unwrapped food, raw meat and fish, prescription medicines, uncovered blades, seeds, bulbs and flowers, or live fish. Retailers need to keep track of how many plastic bags they've given out and where the proceeds have gone, and report this to government by the 31st of May every year. We expect good causes to benefit from the charge by tens of millions of pounds each year.
So there you go. That's all really clear, what you can have in your plastic bag. However, the fun doesn't stop there, because Annie will explain. Annie, a plastic carrier bag you'd think is really simple, but not quite.
No, not if you're a retailer. The gov.uk guidance says that a bag is considered as such if it has an opening and isn't sealed. You must charge at least 5p a bag for carrier bags that are all of the following: unused, plastic with handles, and 70 microns thick or less. Also, there's guidance here on returnable multiple reuse bags, or bags for life as we call them, and what is acceptable. So they must be sold for 5p or more and at least 404 millimetres in either width or height by 439 millimetres. And you can't count the following in your bag's dimensions: gussets and handles, unless they're on wavy top bags. It does go on, and there are 13 points for checkout staff to memorise when you should give a bag for free and not charge that 5p.
It's a crystal clear, everybody.
Yeah. Even George Orwell never imagined a world like this.
On that note, editor Simon Lambert, Lee Boyce, thank you so much for joining us.
Share Radio.